Is climate change causing property values to rise faster in parts of Miami? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today we'll learn how climate change and rising seas are possibly making some neighborhoods' values change. We'll talk to the researcher behind the new study out of Harvard University. Also today we ask, what's the future for the Miami Heat? Plus, a major investment fund for startups has left Silicon Valley and now calls Miami home. And
Dad was born on this farm. Here's our house. Here's the spot where he died. I can draw a circle. His whole life fits inside.
The Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home is at the Arts Center. Some of the actors from the Zoetic Stage production join us. That's all today on Sundial. First, the news.
Shore to shore on its way from the Castro to Christopher Street.
Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, a new study out of Harvard University finds Miami's real estate market is already seeing the effects of climate change. The 10-page report explores the changes in property values in Miami's highest elevation neighborhoods over the past several decades relative to those closer to the sea level. Well, Jesse Keenan is the co-author of the study and a professor of architecture in Harvard's Graduate School of Design. Jesse, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me today.
So why is Miami the case study for this research? I mean, you have cities like New York, New Orleans, Baltimore. They all face high exposure to sea level rise.
Sure. One of the reasons that we chose Miami was a great deal of geographic exposure in terms of a coastline and small but important variations in elevation. Other communities or cities, let's say like New York, have actually fairly great variations in elevation relative to flood exposure and risk. And Miami is somewhat unique in the sense that Dade County is fairly flat, relatively speaking. And we anticipated as part of our initial set of hypotheses, and we could talk about that, that there was perhaps something unique about South Florida in particular where increased tidal flooding, increased nuisance flooding, something that had been showing up in observational studies and scientific literature could also be influencing perception. And I think a big part of what many researchers are trying to understand is where we draw distinctions in terms of price appreciation, rates of price appreciation, and let's say transactional data, how we understand that as a function of actual hazard, actual risk, or the perception thereof. And I think Miami represented an opportunity to look at both sides of the equation, what's happening now and how people are interpreting the future.
All right. Your study connects elevation and resiliency measures with how much property values have risen. What neighborhoods are seeing prices rise slower, and which neighborhoods are seeing the faster increases?
So let me back up just one second. Say we tested two hypotheses. The first hypothesis was that there would be a relation and a correlation between the rate of price appreciation and elevation. The second hypothesis we tested, the nuisance hypothesis. So we hypothesized that the lowest elevation cohorts, we broke up properties going back to 1971 to the first half of 2017. We hypothesized that the lowest elevation cohort, that is the in 1 meter increments, would start to underperform the rest of the elevations around the year 2000, which is basically when you see in the scientific literature in terms of observational studies that we get increased tidal flooding, increased nuisance flooding that has various degrees of attribution related to relative sea level rise. We found that specifically across the county, there was a pretty strong relationship. When we looked at a more sophisticated statistic, so that was a strong relationship in the kind of raw data by the elevation. When we accounted for various attributes of property, age, size, other attributes relating to usually valuation, that there's a proposition in coastal real estate where properties closer to the to the coast, greater amenities thereof, they appreciate faster and they're worth more. Higher income properties or higher value properties generally appreciate faster. So we had to look at and control for a number of different variables. And we did. And when we looked at that, and we looked at these coefficients, if you will, and we mapped them out, we were actually quite surprised because there's flooding as an issue across the county, the western side, the Everglades, South Dade, et cetera. But what was really surprising to us when we mapped these things out, that the highest coefficients were right along the coast. And in fact, in the north portions of the county along Biscayne Bay in particular, where we've actually seen the most amount of tidal flooding and nuisance flooding, where you start to see the strongest coefficients or the strongest relationship.
All right, so basically, but what I want to get that though is this, is let's say I own a single family home, let's say in Miami Beach. Is it fair to say that the percentage of my property value has risen over the past several decades is much lower than, say, higher elevation like Little Haiti?
Sure. So that gets us to the second hypothesis, which was the nuisance hypothesis. And in that, we found that around the year 2000, that lowest elevation cohort started to separate and drop off in the sense that it was not appreciating as fast, which implicit in that means that some properties are keeping up with the rate inflation. They're appreciating, no doubt, implicit in this is some discounting that's happening for lower elevation properties. This could be a combination of perception and a combination of actual risk, hazard, the cost of insurance, etc. To your question about neighborhoods in particular, there's no doubt that in certain high elevation neighborhoods that there is a lot of development and gentrification, and we believe that's largely attributed to just natural infill gentrification. The pressures, we've run out of land in the county for development, and now we're starting to infill. This is a natural proposition that you would see. It comes at great costs, of course, social costs, environmental costs, and the like, but it's something that we would anticipate by virtue of running out of land. So there are specific neighborhoods where that is more recognizable. I think what we found in our results was that, you know, particularly going up Biscayne, that those neighborhoods that have those strongest correlations are likely to be exacerbated as sea level rise increases in its intensity, which recent satellite data and recent scientific evidence suggests that the rate of annualized relative sea level rise, both as global mean sea level rise and local relative sea level rise, is accelerating.
All right. Let me just get to the basic question here. Does your study say that climate change is having an impact right now on property values in Miami-Dade County? And if so, what I want to know is just how much of a connection is that? Because, I mean, as you said, we have, you know, all these other factors involved, but how much of a connection is the sea level rise, the climate change having on that property value, on those property values?
Two things. There's a lot of inference here. There's no doubt that flooding, nuisance flooding, and tidal flooding, it seems pretty clear when spatializing the data that that the greatest effect and impact is in areas where we know it's happening, where we know tidal flooding is causing problems. Buyers and sellers are likely inferring that in the future they're going to have future discounts. But that being said, climate change or sea level rise in particular has a certain function of attribution. It isn't explaining all of it. It's only explaining part of the ongoing flooding that's happening. So it's evidence, but it's by no means definitive as to these relationships and these behaviors. It's social behavior. It's economics. It'll take many more years of research to understand exactly how households are making decisions and why, but this is at least the first real early evidence to suggest that such a signal exists.
And does your study in any way project what we might expect in the coming decades? Or, as you said, do we need just more research?
Yeah, we need more research, but you could infer that based on those coefficients that areas along Biscayne that are proximate to low elevation, Little River, moving up north, you know, Key Biscayne, et cetera, you would anticipate that those relationships, those effects, if you will, more precisely, would increase in their to the detriment of property owners.
I'm speaking with Jesse Keenan, author of the new study out of Harvard University that examines changes in real estate costs relative to elevation and resiliency in Miami. Is climate gentrification already happening in our city. He's joining us, by the way, from studios up at Harvard University. Mr. Keenan, help us understand, what is climate gentrification? What's the basic definition?
Sure. The theory of climate gentrification is a proposition that helps explain why destabilization in neighborhoods and speculative investment in neighborhoods may be occurring. And it happens one of three ways. One is the superior investment pathway, if you will. And in this case, people are moving from a high exposure area to a low exposure area. This may be low elevation to high elevation. It may be where forest fires happen and where they don't happen, et cetera, et cetera. Another pathway is the cost burden pathway. And this is a kind of reverse gentrification, wherein the cost of insurance, property taxes, special assessments, and a general burden in terms of economic productivity are such that it drives out lower to moderate income populations, and it's really only the wealthy who can afford to live in this situation. And finally, the final pathway is the resilience investment pathway. And this is somewhat counterintuitive to the general narrative, but this is based on an actual case that happened in Copenhagen, where we make investments in the built environment to promote resilience, and they have they increase the performance of the built environment. It may be a water system, it may be greater amenities by virtue of aesthetics, parks, etc. But it has the unintended consequences of increasing the value of that area, that district, that brings in additional investment. And in the case of the St. Kjeld neighborhood in Copenhagen, they did a wonderful job. They took a neighborhood that was really economically challenged, brought up its level of water infrastructure. Really, it was a pinnacle moment for resilience design in Northern Europe, but it had the effect of driving out a number of residents, unfortunately.
So that's a good point, and I want to use that as an example. Is, look, we face this challenge here in South Florida, especially Miami, and cities like Miami, where, you know, finding affordable housing for people is a challenge. But we also have to deal with this issue of rising seas. And so now we have to figure out, how do we make this city more resilient? And what is that city going to look like in the future? Is there a way, have you seen an example anywhere, or what did you find in your studies, where we can build a more resilient city and yet not have a negative impact on some of those communities that you're talking about?
So with climate adaptation, there's going to be winners and losers. It's about trade-offs. We would hope that there's democratic processes in place and due process so that communities can decide what they want to protect, what they want to give up,
but you're
who benefits and who pays.
You're saying there are going to be losers, though.
There will absolutely be losers. And I think the question that we have to have for ourselves and for our elected politicians is, in a place like Miami, can we develop density and smart density on high elevation areas where we have inclusionary affordable housing, where we include in that proposition an accommodation for the people who are being displaced. And by the way, coincidentally enough, along the metro rail, as well as the future Bright Line, that's fairly high elevation. So when you start to connect mobility, accessibility, affordable housing, and density, it's going to be painful. Again, there will be winners and losers. There will be many costs. But we actually have an opportunity, I think, shape the morphology of the city in a way that we can densify in a more sustainable manner. And I think that that will yield a lot of co-benefits, from transportation to public health to a variety of other socioeconomic indicators.
I wanted to cue up this conversation that I had with Eric Trump, son of now President Donald Trump. This is during the 2016 presidential campaign. I asked him if he thinks his father would respond to sea level rise as we've seen in Miami. Here's his response.
We have a lot of oceanfront properties. I think you probably know better than anybody. We have a lot of buildings down Miami, and we have a lot of buildings. We have a lot of property, all over South Florida. And I think my father's very pragmatic. I think obviously understands environment, and he's gotten, quite frankly, as a company, we've gotten tremendous environmental awards. Very, very important. It's common sense, but it's also important.
All right. Mr. Keenan, do you believe that the impact of climate change and sea level rise on real estate could be the primary motivator for action, perhaps on a federal level?
This is an economic proposition. So at the enterprise level and private sector, this is bottom line economics. in the public finance realm, this is going to impact tax rolls. It's going to impact the credit worthiness of municipalities and counties to be able to float bonds, to have interventions relating to resilience and adaptation. But more fundamentally, from the federal government's point of view, in the extent to which the NFIP, and that is the National Flood Insurance Program, is largely subsidized by taxpayers not along the coast, if you will, we're in a huge hole. And the idea that slowly but surely we're going to have to bring up flood insurance premiums to actuarial rates is going to hurt. And it's going to hurt an awful lot of people. And I think we need to be prepared as a matter of public policy to connect the dots, to think about how we help transition people away from the coast that may not necessarily be in an immediate inundation zone, but otherwise cannot necessarily afford the cost burden associated with higher insurance premiums. So This is a fairly simple economic calculation, and people may deny climate science. They may hone in on degrees of uncertainty, which in fact do exist. But the certainty associated with even modest levels of sea level rise in Miami-Dade County in particular are about as certain as the extent to which you get on a plane and you can anticipate that it's not going to crash.
We see it every day. Absolutely. I have to end it there, though. Jesse Kenyon, again, is the co-author of a new study from Harvard University, and it looks at Miami's real estate market and the impact climate change is having on it. Mr. Kenyon joined us again from the studios at Harvard University. Mr. Kenyon, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to look back on a very disappointing heat season. That's next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the Miami Heat season came to a close Tuesday. They lost to the Philadelphia 76ers in round one of the playoffs. I spoke with Andre Fernandez, sports reporter for the Miami Herald recently, about owner Pat Riley's response and the future of the team.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see because you saw the way that, Riley really thought this group could work, coming off last season's finish, especially, in the early going, we know how difficult it was when they were 11-30, but then the team showed a lot of fight, a lot of chemistry going down the stretch last year. But this year was a year where there were moments where it looked like it was working, and then moments where you left yourself wondering, why are they falling to these bad teams? A lot of inconsistency. Some of that obviously had to do with injuries. Hassan Whiteside from the beginning of the season wasn't really himself, and then that became a story all of its own, for different reasons. But, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. I think Pat Riley right now knows he has to make some kind of moves depending on, obviously, the whole Whiteside situation and other things, because just looking at the big picture as a whole, this Philadelphia 76ers team looked far better than the Heat overall in terms of talent, in terms of young talent, and they're not the only ones. There's a lot of teams right now in the Eastern Conference that look like they're more prepared to make a run at the finals than they do. You can name the Celtics in that. The Toronto Raptors are definitely another team on the rise. So for the Heat to catch up, they really need to find a way to maybe whether they keep maybe a core group of young guys, like say, a Josh Richardson and guys like that, or keep Goran Dragic as a veteran with experience, but different, this group right now is not enough to get to where they ultimately would like to go, to get back to the point they were, when the Big Three was here. And I think it has to be addressed in the offseason. I think that's what Riley's looking at right now.
And is there a big free agent, a big name out there that he might want to pursue?
Well, the one that keeps popping up that ESPN was speculating was Kawhi Leonard of the San Antonio Spurs, because his situation where he got hurt and he's been, keeping basically not playing the entire season, waiting to get fully healthy. It'll be interesting to see where he lands. The speculation was that maybe the Heat could package a Goran Dragic or maybe a couple of other players to put an enticing deal together to get him to Miami. But that may be a pretty tough deal to pull off. I mean, right now Miami owes a lot of money to a lot of players that are currently on their roster, and, contract situations would need, settling there. So, I mean, that's the only one I could see, maybe, if they could somehow find a way. I mean, Pat Riley's done this before where we're thinking maybe they're not in a position to make a move, and then he does. But definitely something needs to be addressed, and I think a lot of it has to do with the structure of this team right now.
So the big question, of course, also is Dwayne Wade. What happens to him? Is he finished? Is his career over?
I don't think we're going to see Dwayne Wade leave Miami again and play somewhere else. But the interesting part is going to be, can it work with this roster again? Because the role that he was brought for was to give that lift off the bench, to be that two guard, that guy that really puts everything together, opens things up for their other guards and other shooters. I can see him come back because I think him personally, this late push showed that he still has something to contribute. He's not just there on a team, you know what I mean? Like, there's other players maybe that are getting up in age in the NBA that maybe they're just coming off the bench, you know, playing a few minutes here and there. But Dwayne made a real positive impact on this team and was a contributor. And down the stretch for a while, he was their best player. I think at this point in his career, he's pretty much set both personally and in terms of achievements in basketball. I mean, he said he's going to take a little while to think about it. We've talked about him and Udonis Haslam, the close friendship. He talked about that during the series, about what they may do together if they decide this is it for them. So I think you're seeing a scenario where if it makes sense for him to come back, he will. If not, we probably saw his last game overall in the NBA because, you know, I don't think he's walking away again to go anywhere else.
And again, that is Miami Herald sports reporter Andre Fernandez talking about the Miami Heat season. It's over. What's going to come next for the team? Well, we have an offseason to think about that. Still to come, a major fund for startups has said goodbye to Silicon Valley, now calls Miami home. We'll find out why. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami and Fort Lauderdale have been listed as the number one region in the country for startups. The news is clearly spreading as 500 startups, the $400 million fund, has decided to call Miami home. This is the fund that helped create Credit Karma and Twilio. We're joined now by Anna Gonzalez, who's heading up 500 startups in Miami. Anna, it is a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Liz. A pleasure.
You corrected me on something. I want to make sure. See, I said it left Silicon Valley to come to Miami. You didn't really leave Silicon Valley, did you?
Right. So we started in Silicon Valley in 2010, but our thesis from the very beginning was, let's go global. There are a lot of resources being poured into Silicon Valley, and we think there's talent everywhere. Opportunity is not. So we're in a good position to go and help develop nascent ecosystems. So our mission is go around the world and discover and back talented entrepreneurs and develop those nascent ecosystems that will help them thrive.
And why Miami? I mean, all these places around the world, why here?
Right. So we're already pretty global. 8 years after, we've invested in over 2,000 companies in over 60 countries around the world. But one of the first regions we started diving deep into was Latin America. We've invested in over 160 companies there. So for us, Miami is a very important operation, I would say, in two senses. The first, it's a very good place to become an international hub. It truly has that potential. It's connected to Latin America. For us, it also means more exposure to the East Coast, and it's potentially a gateway to enter Latin America for Europe, Africa, other regions. But the second piece is what's happening in Miami, which is also really interesting.
All right, let's talk about that. Okay, so I mean, Miami could be all of these opportunities, but what do you see here that's happening that makes this so attractive? What's the local talent, the local ideas that make this a really good place to be?
So Miami has been developing as a very interesting space for startups to start locally or move into. I think one thing that's really important to highlight, the base of the Miami demographics are very, very diverse compared to many other ecosystems in the U.S. or worldwide. So we think that Miami has all the ingredients to become a truly diverse and thriving ecosystem. So we want to help build that. The second piece is what's already happening here. So whether it be the local talent, investors that are starting to discover that they can start a startup and they have the resources, an investor that would typically put money in real estate or another less risky asset is saying, oh, wait a minute, this is interesting, I can get money here. So that's local. And then people around the world saying, you know, I like Miami, I want to live there, I want to make something interesting for myself in Miami, and I'm going to move there. So it's, I feel like everyone is coming together to realize Miami has something very special to offer, and we're still trying to figure out how that's going to come together.
Are there some startups right now that you're looking at that you think these are really interesting players?
Yes, we just started our series of two-day boot camps for entrepreneurs. And for our first call for applicants, just for a two-day boot camp, we had over 110 applications of really, really good startups. I think some sectors are looking very interesting for here. It's logistics and transportation, it's travel and hospitality, it's health tech, it's fintech, it's prop tech. And so I'm seeing startups that are both in early stage or trying to raise their Series A rounds that are doing things really well and just need a little extra nudge on the support side, mentorship side. They need some support also on the fundraising, but that are poised to become very important national or global players.
Is it about making South Florida and Miami the big tech hub? Is it about making it the next, as people like to use this phrase, we want to be the next Silicon Valley? Is it about that in any way?
No, I think not at all. And I think that no other ecosystem can replicate what Silicon Valley has done, or any other ecosystem. Each ecosystem needs to find its own DNA and recognize what are the natural advantages and strengths. So no, I don't think startups should be built the way they are built in Silicon Valley. The talent is different. The access to resources is different. The markets are different. So what are the industries where Miami is already strong that can be disrupted, where there's more expertise, where there's more resources? And I think, you know, something I like in Miami that we don't see in the Valley, people are thinking of building real profitable businesses from the outset just because there's not so much capital to count on throughout your journey, which is different from the Valley. Sometimes people are building crazy companies, raising a lot of money and still not monetized. So I think Miami is unique and should exploit that.
You keep using the word ecosystems. How do you define that for me, the way you define it?
Well, for us, an ecosystem is a network with a certain amount of density where everybody will find a place for themselves to thrive. So there's enough density of talent to join startups that are doing interesting things that will then be available, will be able to raise capital from investors because they are looking at the startups and their corporates that are giving access to markets for these startups. So you have all the different pieces, also the universities, the government supporting with regulation and incentives. So all these different pieces that have to come together like a puzzle in order to help the startups thrive.
Are there any weaknesses, though, that you could point to?
In Miami? Oh, yeah, of course. It's still very nascent. So everybody keeps talking about talent. People say there is talent or is there not. I think there's good talent at junior levels that for now still keeps living the region for better opportunities outside. So there's a real lack of middle management talent. And I think we're also starting to see the first wave of successful entrepreneurs that are having good exits that are coming back to found their second company and are becoming mentors for the next generation. So that's just starting to happen.
Yeah, you talk about that talent wanting to leave after they finish school. So what do we have to do to convince them, don't, stay right here?
Well, it's like a chicken and egg, right? So you need good startups to offer attractive jobs in the market for talent to stay. But then if the startups are not finding the talent at the outset, they have little incentives to stay here themselves. So I think it's just creating the network little by little. And as we have more good startups that offer the talent alternatives, you know, they join a startup, but it's a risky business. So at least they know if this doesn't work out, I have another option. And sometimes that entails moving their own families, their whole family. So if there are different options for the talent, they know there's a market for them and they can stay.
All right. You talked about also being the gateway to Latin America. I mean, Miami's always been seen as that. It is the gateway to the Caribbean, the gateway to South America. But what do you see or what have you seen in startups and tech companies coming out of Latin America? I mean, can you name one, for example, that's really been strong? Or what do you hope to see anyway coming from there?
Yeah, well, we have had very successful investments in Latin America. Fintech is a very strong sector. So Conecta or Clip are doing a lot of great work in financial inclusion. Brazil is a very big market as well. We have Viva Real in real estate. I think Latin America, it's funny because people think of Latin America as one bucket, one region. It has a lot of nuances in different markets, but there are great startups that are starting to capture those different markets. And Miami, it's a great place for a startup to have a headquarter to connect with all the different countries in the region.
Are they already coming here for that, though? Are these companies in all these other Latin American countries, are they looking at Miami as that place they want to come and be? Or is 500 startups the kind of thing that's going to attract them and say, hey, you're doing business in Colombia or in Venezuela or in Chile or wherever, but come to Miami, set it up here. This is a better place.
So this is a very common practice in the corporate world, and it's just starting in terms of startups, which is also normal. You start in Mexico, you start in Brazil, and you're not thinking about your second international office. But as we start getting leaner, and operations are already getting much leaner for everyone with the leverage of technology, I think that this will be able to be leveraged much more going into the future. You have a small team in Miami in a co-working space that it's affordable, and you're able to connect all the different countries from Miami, and you're able to jump on a plane much easier. You know, if you want to go from Mexico to Panama, the cheapest way sometimes is you have to stop in Miami. How ridiculous is that? Well, let's take advantage of it.
All right, so let's finish up with this. Where can South Florida and Miami be in 10 years if you've got 500 startups helping push that innovation? What do you see?
Well, hopefully it will be a hotbed of innovation in very specific sectors where Miami will have become very strong. And so people around the world, when they say, I'm building a really innovative company in fintech or prop tech, or I'm leveraging AR and VR, or I'm doing health tech, I have to go to Miami and work on my startup there.
Again, talking with Anna Gonzalez, she heads up 500 Startups. That is a $400 million fund now here set up in Miami, trying to help startups get going. Let's see where we take Miami. Look, Miami-Fort Lauderdale already the number one startup region in the country. Anna Gonzalez, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Got to have you back and see how that's growing here in South Florida. Still to come, the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home is at the Arts Center. WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman is going to give us a preview. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Broadway hit musical Fun Home is up at the Arts Center right now. It's performed by Zoetic Stage. Here to talk about the show is WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman with some of the company members.
Someone just came in the door, like no one I ever saw before. I feel, I don't know where you came from. I wish I did, I feel so dumb. I feel your swagger and your bearing and just right clothes you're wearing, your short hair and your dungarees and your lace-up boots and your keys, oh, your ring of keys.
That's the song Ring of Keys from the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home, that won the Tony Award for Best Musical in 2015. It's based on the graphic memoir, it's like the graphic novel, but actually a memoir called A Family Tragicomic, Fun Home by Alison Bechdel. She's also well known for her comic strip Dykes to Watch Out For. The music is by Janine Tesori. The lyrics and book are by Lisa Crone. Fun Home follows Allison's journey to coming out and the revelation that her father was also gay and his suicide while she was in college a few months after she came out. The show runs through May 13th, and here with me now are the actors playing adult Allison, Annalise Jensen, and college Allison, Kimmy Johnson, and also Zoetic Stage co-founder Michael McKeever. Thank you all for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, first of all, Fun Home, the title of the show, doesn't quite refer to what people might think of when they imagine a fun home. You want to take that?
Sure. It's it kind of plays in so many different elements of the musical and of the graphic novel itself. It stands for the funeral home that the family owns and runs. But at the same time, the children who grow up in this environment create their own fantasy world, this amazing world that they live in, and they dub it Fun Home.
And it's so, you know, the story is such a journey. I mean, so much of it takes place in this small Pennsylvania town called Beach Creek, Pennsylvania. And it's really about, I think, some of the limitations of what it felt like to grow up in a place like that. Why did Zoetic Stage, Michael, why did Zoetic Stage want to do this show?
When the show first came out and first played off Broadway, the artistic director, Stuart Meltzer, found out about it and researched it and said, this sounds like a show that I think we would be a good fit for us. Then he read the script and heard the score, heard the soundtrack, and he was just blown away. It's not only an incredibly detailed and well-written book, but it's also one of the best Broadway musical scores that have been written in the past 10 years or so. It's why it won all the Tonys that it walked away with. And Stuart just thought it would be a really good fit for the vibe that Zoetic has here down in Miami. And so we really campaigned to get it, and we were thrilled when we did.
And what did that say? You say you campaigned to get it. So it's not just like you decide you want to put on a show. There's more to it than that.
Oh, no, no. When you've got a show as good as Fun Home that's out there, you've got a bunch of theaters all vying to get it because it's such a great property. And there's a national tour going of the show going around the country, but it wasn't coming down south to South Florida. And so we really wanted to bring this show to the Miami and South Florida audiences.
And one of the things we get by it not being a national touring company is that it's in a very small theater.
Well, one of the things we love about working at the Arts Center, and there's so many things we love about being a resident company there, is that we get to play in the Carnival Studio Theater, which is a 200-seat house, which is just so intimate. The audience is right up there, real close to the audiences. To the stage, and there's this great intimacy that happens between the actors and the performers and the audience. We all become one, as opposed to the bigger houses where the bigger Broadway shows play.
Sure, 200 seats, yeah, it's small. So the way this show is structured is that there are three actors playing Allison throughout the course of the show, sometimes individually, sometimes simultaneously overlapping. And so, as I said, here with us now are the adult Allison, and in the show it actually says, I think in the program it says medium Allison, right?
Yes.
Right, and that's the college Allison. And what we heard at the beginning was small Allison, the kid singing Ring of Keys, and that was about that discovery of seeing a woman who was presumably lesbian and having this sort of spark of recognition, this like unbelievable spark of recognition. Kimmy and Annalise, can you both talk about preparing for the role of playing the same character with three of you on stage at the same time and what that was like and maybe what the interaction amongst each other was like?
Sure. So as adult Allison, I actually took a back seat a little bit to my younger counterparts to watch what they naturally did. They are living in real time, and I'm living in retrospect, in memory. So if Kimmy, as myself in college, interacted with my father in a certain way, then that's my memory. So if that naturally, organically happened, it was easier for me to say, oh, yes, that was a behavior that we had. That was something that makes sense to me now. And so then to just accept that as truth and then move on. We did talk a fair amount. Do you remember some of the things we've talked about?
Yeah, we talked about, you know, how Allison would feel about intimacy in general, how Allison would feel about, you know, these books that her dad is making her read. We would text each other, and after rehearsal, during rehearsal, would just take a moment and check in and make sure that either we were thinking the same thing or we figured out something to agree upon together. And it's funny that you mentioned that you looked at what I was doing, because I use your lines to kind of inform, you know, what medium Allison, how she felt about these certain things. You know, the show is a series of vignettes, you know, it's not like a linear thing. It doesn't happen all at once. So, you know, to kind of help clue me back into what I'm about to say and what I'm about to do, I listen to what you, Allison, big Allison, say right before, and throughout the process I kind of underlined those words in the script to be like, oh, so she's embarrassed here, or she thinks this is silly, or, you know, all of those wonderful things that are there in the script. I definitely use that along with everything Annalise did and says in the show as well.
one of the moments, one of Medium Allison's big moments in the show, and again, the show is about this journey towards coming out. I think the two themes are like the journey towards coming out, and of course it's intertwined with the other big theme, which is just this relationship with her father and that dynamic. And in some moments, it seems like they're so close, and in some moments, it feels like they're a million miles apart from each other. But there's the college, one of the college scenes with Medium Allison, with College Allison, where she makes this big discovery. I mean, when we hear Ring of Keys with the little kid at that memory, that's like that little spark, but then something changes. And so let's listen to some of the song Changing My Major from the Broadway cast recording. And I just do need to let people know here that this song is about discovering, among other things, sex.
Must say that I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan, with a minor in kissing Joan. Foreign study to Joan's inner thighs, a seminar on Joan's ass in her Levi's, and Joan's crazy brown eyes. Joan, I feel like Hercules. Oh God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work on calming down, so by the time you've woken up, I'll
be changing my major to Joan. You know, you both are also teachers. Annalise and Kimmy, you teach presumably students who are about this age, maybe younger, college age. I wonder how much when you're doing a role like this, and maybe there isn't a role like this, when you're doing this role, how much does it come into play thinking about your own students or thinking about the work you do with people in this age group?
I think absolutely. I mean, a lot of behavior is observed in a high school setting, and, you know, just going to college for the first time. It's a combination, I think, of my observation and like personal Kimmy-isms that, you know, I've kind of combined to make who Medium Allison is, or Allison is. But I think a lot of it does come from, you know, what I see every day in high school and, you know, the jittery, awkward feelings. But I think a lot of it does come from my own silly, awkward tendencies. So I think it's a combination of both.
It sounds like the casting is good here in some ways.
The casting, I have to tell you, the casting is fantastic. There were a lot of people who auditioned for the roles in this play, and Stuart Meltzer did such a great job, not only in casting amazing actors and singers, but people that have really this magical chemistry. And the thing that's really incredible too is you see these three different girls. You see small Allison, medium Allison, and grown Allison, and they look like they could have been the same person growing up. It's really quite special to see.
You know, you use the word chemistry, and that did strike me. I didn't quite think of it in that way, but hearing you say it, when I saw the performance, when I saw the Zoetic Stage production of Fun Home, the chemistry among the actors was really there, and also the relationship to the character, because I did see it on Broadway, and I sort of had that sort of basis of comparison, and I thought that you did hit these, you really believed, like, and also I read the graphic novel, I mean, you really believed that, like, each of you were inhabiting that part of Allison's life and her personality. And you talked a little bit about how you did that, but like in something like Changing My Major to Joan, you know, like what goes into that when it's something that's like you're trying to put yourself in this place where something is truly a revelation?
I mean, I think a lot of work that I do is relating it back to a moment in my life and thinking like how I felt about it. But I also think that there is so much meat in the song itself. A lot of times you are gifted with incredible material, and this song is 5 minutes of everything she's feeling. And the music underneath it is totally just accompanies the feeling and the larger than life doubting herself, but also screaming at the top of her lungs excitement. So it's kind of just like listening and using the words, using the text, using the notes that were given to us. That's always what I come back to. And, you know, then just really putting yourself in that space. Our production doesn't exactly have every prop that you would have in a dorm room, but we have a bed and a blanket and a Joan, and that's really all that I need. We do have these awesome turntables in our show too that literally sweep us off of our feet and circle us around. And there's an awesome moment where I'm, you know, walking and then let the turntable spin me around, and that is such a unique and awesome experience that I bring into the song as well, and just let it take me and let it take my breath away. Really, it does.
The turntables, yeah. I mean, I was just thinking, like, choreographically, that looked really hard. Like, it looked, and a lot about this show, I mean, it's a demanding show. It's theatrically demanding. It's musically very demanding. And it's certainly emotionally demanding. What has that been like for you? How have you navigated all of that?
Oh, man. I'm still figuring it out, I think. Especially because that we all committed to this show and then also committed to cutting our hair. So that was an interesting thing.
And cutting your hair because that was the character.
Yeah.
The character has short hair.
And so important to her story. There's a line that little Allison says, you know, her father is mad at her for not having her barrette in. And he says, if you don't put it back in, I'll whale you. And he says, it keeps the hair out of your eyes. And she says, so would a crew cut. And it's very important to her very early that she not have things in her way. She's very simple. She wants things to be clean and true. And so it was kind of a non-start for me. Like, I had to do it. I knew I had to do it. But then, like, you know, the first day I woke up afterwards, I was like, oh, she's with me all the time now.
Oh, like, wow. So how long was your hair before that?
About to my collarbone, so... and I've had short hair before, but this...
is for the character.
Yeah. And so it's like, I don't take off my costume. You know, she comes home with me. I wake up with her. We're together all the time. So we identify a lot with her. And I really enjoy her, but it's certainly hard to go through that journey every night.
There's a point in the show when adult Allison remembers something that happened when she and her father were in a car together. This is a song that you sing in the play, in the musical in Fun Home. But she's also imagining at the same time something that could have happened and things that she, the way that she wishes that car ride might have gone differently. This is the song Telephone Wire.
Telephone wire, run and run. Telephone wire, sundown on the creek. Partly frozen, partly flowing. Must be windy, trees are bending. Junction 50, field needs mowing. Feels like the car is floating. Say something, talk to him. Say something, anything. At the light, at the light, at the light, at the light. At the light, at the light, at the light, at the light. Like you could say. That you and I are both...
Hey.
Yeah.
Where do you want to go?
Oh, I don't know.
I know a bar. It's kind of
right after
hidden
21.
Away.
I'm not 21.
Sure.
CD club for folks like, you know, could be fun.
I haven't listened to this in a long time.
But Dad, I'm not 21.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. We've been talking about the musical Fun Home. Zoetic Stage is performing the show at the Arts Center through May 13th. Annalise Jensen, Kimmy Johnson, and Michael McKeever, congratulations on such a beautiful production, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, Alicia. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you again on Monday.